Okay, so we'll begin the afternoon Q&A session. I'll start with the online questions first. Okay, thank you for your teaching on the five hindrances. I deeply appreciate loving kindness practice as an antidote for aversion as well as for worry and other forms of strife. For me, loving kindness is a healing and sustaining practice. And at the same time, I realize that in moving to loving kindness, I may be missing some of the deeper insights and wisdom that are present in feelings of anger, ill will, and resentment. I think this is what is referred to as spiritual bypassing. Can you speak to this distinction or provide suggestions for accessing the wisdom that may be present within or underneath the hindrances and not bypassing it? Thank you. Well, I mean, of course, this is nuanced. Yeah, one doesn't need to, how do you say, wallow in the hindrances just to sort of get the feel for it. it's important to recognize the suffering, and it's also true that sometimes people just don't want to deal with. Okay, I don't want to deal with aversion and ill will, and I'll just get a nice coating of loving kindness on top of it, and then I don't have to deal with it, which is, I mean, that is definitely spiritual bypassing. So, I mean, I think one of the things that is, you know, all of our spiritual practice requires is tremendous honesty. You know, you really need to be honest with yourself, and we know when we're trying to fool ourselves, and we want to be working with that. You know, that said, there's no point in looking for more suffering than we already have. So it's just really trying to get that balance of what is it that gives an insight, and certainly that reflecting on the whatever hindrances there are, in that sense of, you know, what's the motivation? What's it trying to gratify? What's it trying to what relief from suffering is it trying to get? Because certainly, sensual desire is just trying to get a relief from suffering. Even anger and ill will is just trying to displace some kind of aversion or bias of some sort, and it's just trying to displace it, so one can externalize it, and then you can demonize somebody or something, and you don't have to deal with it, which is not quite true, but people try to make it work, in the same with all the rest of the hindrances. They're looking for some relief from suffering in some way, shape, or form, so that we have to be willing to reflect and investigate what's he trying to do, and then work from that basis in order to free the mind from its underlying tendency. Would you speak about your response to the events in Israel and Gaza? Thank you so much for this opportunity. Well, I mean, the world has been a sad place for a long time, and say, yeah, Israel and Gaza have been sad places for a long time, and so that it's continuing to follow that trajectory. It's just the any kind of loss of life and inhumanity to each other is sad, and this in particular is so sort of tangled over 2,000 years ago, the Israelites and the Philistines were fighting each other then, and they've been doing it all along. So I mean, it is a particularly, it's just sad. Human beings creating suffering for each other, and as on both sides, it's not. I don't think there's any way one can sort of hold up an idealistic view of humanity in any of it. Question for Jampasano. Could you please elaborate on how you generate the images and feelings of metta? I've been practicing a long time, yet my metta practice, repeating phrases, always seems a bit dry. I'd love to learn your way of practicing metta. Now, I can appreciate that, because generally, I've certainly found the same thing with the phrases, classical commentarial kind of tradition of the various phrases and repeating them. Dry. And of course, that's not what metta is supposed to be. Metta is a warm feeling with a sense of, and I think part of it is reflecting on, and you can't just use phrases because they're in a book and the book has been there for 1500 years. You have to really pay attention to what works for oneself or what could work. That's why the you could use an image or a memory of your cat when it was a kitten. I mean, it's anything to elicit the feeling, because the how do you say, metta practice is not about the repeating of the phrases. I mean, you can use those phrases if they work, but the function of metta practice is to create a feeling in the heart, which is the, I mean, that's what they say, metta nimitta, that's the sign of loving kindness and sort of that feeling in the heart. So when the phrases that I, and I've, phrases that I use are, and I got this from Bhante Gunaratana, his way of teaching loving kindness. I found it works for me. But even still, just continually repeating phrases doesn't do it either. You've got to elicit imagery that helps to bring a sense of warmth, so that eliciting imagery of beings who one cares for and really wants those people to be happy and to live And as I said, that maybe a better translation of loving, say what is translated as loving kindness is well wishing. It's that wishing well, because you don't really need to be all that kind of gushing with love and kindness. You just try to be nice to people. So it's just try to be, and recognizing that we all have that wish for well-being. The phrases that I use, may I be well, happy, and peaceful. May no harm come to me. May no difficulty come to me. May I always experience spiritual success, that well-wishing. May have the patience, courage, understanding, and determination to meet and overcome inevitable difficulties, problems, and failures in life. May I always meet them with virtue and integrity, kindness and compassion, mindfulness and wisdom. So that setting that wish in the mind and eliciting that sense of warmth and well wishing for myself. And of course then you can be extending that to, and it is important to really solidify that wish for oneself. There's whole lists of different beings that one can be generating that for, and one can do that. But the important foundation is toward oneself, and really giving oneself that. And also, as one generates that wish for oneself, I'd really try to bring it into the heart, as opposed to this repeating the phrases up in the head, and bringing it into the heart. And then as one extends it, because oftentimes it, like metta is okay, I do it to myself, then I do it to my parents, and okay, send it off to my parents, and I send metta off to my teachers, okay, then my friends and relatives, and you're sort of this metta postman running around. it's much more important to establish that in the heart, and what you do, because it is a meditation subject. It's not a duty that you're performing. You're creating a meditative space for yourself. And it's more like having a bowl, and you can visualize beginning with just a small bowl, and then the bowl gets bigger, and then as it gets more and more expansive, from the get-go, you invite the different beings into that space. But the space is always grounded right here. And so to me, that's really important, because we can get really busy with this metta stuff and forget that it's for really laying a solid foundation. Okay, dear Lumpa, I have trouble with maintaining wakefulness and alertness in the afternoon. What guidance would you give to cultivate and develop more skillfulness? Thank you so much for your presence and teachings. There's many different sort of techniques. One of the main ones is just don't close your eyes. It makes a huge difference. Having the eyes open, and you can also, if you want, you can say put something in that visual field that is, settling or soothing, or is at least it's something to keep fixed attention on. I mean, not something distracting, but something, maybe a bit soothing or a bit reminding. But in general, it's just keeping the eyes open makes a huge difference, because that really gives more kind of energy or sensory input, and it helps the mind just not drifting into that kind of liminal state that happens. You breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, pick your head up off the floor. So that's an important aspect. Then also, just like using a more discursive meditations, or say like with. Or keeping mindfulness of breathing, but then using, like in the Thai forest tradition, using a short mantra, the name of the Buddha, on the in-breath, Bhūnyāpattho, Bhūnto, Bhūnto. So it's using that recitation in conjunction with the breath. It gives you a little bit more work to do, because that's what's happening, is the mind doesn't have enough work to do, so it drifts off to sleep. Or using a recollection of the Buddha or Dhamma Sangha, or using a Supagamatthana, not so much as a unattractive meditation on unattractiveness, but a meditation on you got 32 things in a line to recite, and you can't forget, you can't drift, you can't you're and you're when you do, then you know you've drifted. So then that's before you sort of really sort of lose complete mindfulness and wakefulness. So it keeps the mind engaged in a skillful way. So that's, you can do that sitting. Walking meditation is fine, even because sometimes, the early meditations in the afternoon can be, we eat the main meal of the day at noon, and then you sit to meditate. That's why I'm having Q&A at 1 o'clock. I'm not giving a Dhamma talk. Because usually doesn't work so well. It's just cycles of our energy are like that. So it's a an important way of approaching that. So doing walking meditation, keeping the body moving, stand or doing standing meditation. One can, you t if you're doing standing meditation, you tend to find out quicker if you've lost wakefulness, and I can remember one monk at this is when I was still living in Thailand. I found it difficult. Early evening was hard for him, and so he'd sit and drift off to sleep. He said, "Okay, that's it. I'm gonna do standing meditation." So he would stand, and then he would he would stand in front of a door. And then, of course, you could whump, whump. he was hitting his head on the door, and still wasn't quite waking him up. So, you just keep trying, and you develop good habits as well as you keep trying, experimenting with different things. I think I'll read the whole thing. Some of it's personal, but nobody knows who it is. And I think it gives a good context to the question. My gratitude to you first and foremost. A few of my friends who practice Vipassana meditation, Goenka method, suggested over a decade ago that I sign up for a 10-day beginner's course, and to my surprise, my application was declined due to mental health concerns. It was because I had once been hospitalized for chronic pain and depression. My father, who was a Dhamma practitioner back then, said to me, if I wanted it enough, I would find a way. Not too long after that, I remember hearing and listening attentively to Lumpa Sumedho's Dhamma talk recordings and telling my father, I think I'm a Buddhist. And he nodded quietly. I think his father's pretty solid. I have had many losses over the years, and both my parents passed away 6 years ago. I have found that taking refuge in the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, keeping the precepts, and having daily meditation practice helps. There is peacefulness and gratitude. I have heard that if one wants to share merits with the deceased, one could. I have been wondering what is the proper way. Could you give some guidance? Thank you, Lopal. So, it's actually very beautiful, that intention. And that is exactly what is merit, or meritorious. It's not brownie points for being a Buddhist. it's much more around the a recollection of the goodness that one has done, and that sincere wish that, you know, through the goodness that I have done, may my parents benefit, or whoever one is dedicating to. And of course, it can be directed specifically, it can be directed more generally, you know, just the that dedication of, that again, and it's somewhat tied to that well-wishing of loving kindness, but it's a bit more, maybe it's a bit more specific. But also, I think one of the things, it's like the sharing of merit is how it's translated, and it's hard to find a decent translation into English, because it is a concept that's maybe not so familiar to our culture, although not really. In the sense that, you know, we all recognize that goodness, there are benefits to that people can share in. But the word in the scriptural language is punya. And it's kind of a short discourse that the Buddha gives, but he's speaking to the to the monks, and it's, do not be afraid of punya. And so we do. Punya is another word for happiness. So it's like, normally it's the, it's like say the happiness that comes through one's, having that feeling of refuge, Buddha Dhamma Sangha, of keeping the precepts, having a commitment to a training of the heart, a commitment to generosity and kindness. I mean, those are all extremely wholesome activities, and on reflection, they elicit a sense of happiness and well-being. So it's a punya. And then the sense is, and punya is accomplished through the heart itself. It's not, I mean, there's different things that people do in different cultures, in different Buddhist cultures, as a part of dedication of merit. But those are the kind of the vehicle or the avenues of being able to do direct attention. But punya is accomplished through the heart itself, and it's just that intention, that feeling, that wish, and that in itself is the accomplishment of merit. There's an interesting, because it's associated with goodness, it's associated with happiness and well-being. There's a Tibetan saying that I came across, that kind of, a spark of merit is worth more than a mountain of effort. So it's a really interesting, because there is a sense of, that sense of merit in its true sense, the punya, and that sense of happiness and brightness that comes from reflecting on goodness and wanting to do goodness, is kind of, it's really approaching selflessness. And effort can so often be so much me driving, I've got to get this done, I've got to accomplish it, I've got to achieve, I got to get my samadhi, I got to get my jhanas, I got to get my insight, and it's kind of admirable, but also sometimes it's missing the point. So this sense of, how do we soften the heart and really expand that sense? So that merit is one thing, and certainly in terms of that dedication, is just setting that wish in the mind and bringing it to mind in different occasions. And of course, when we're on formal occasions, those are things that that people do. They'll like at the monastery, there will be people will come to the monastery on the anniversary of their say loved one's passing or some other occasions, and ask the community to dedicate chanting. Or people will call us or send emails, would you dedicate chanting for so and so, and that intention, and then knowing that something is being done, there's an accomplishment of punya there, it's just that, say, the activity or the action is the catalyst, but what's really important is the heart behind it.
Of more questions online, and Judy can read them when we decide.
Okay, well, let's do some of these first. Yeah, we'll do these first. Okay. Oh, we're already half an hour through. We haven't even started on our questions. Yeah, we might not make it so far. In practicing mindfulness day to day, how should one be thinking about which category of mindfulness are most, quote unquote, important at various times? Body, feelings, mind, or dhammas? And what's more important is not so much the category, but the degree to which it feels relevant or seems relevant, and you can sustain attention. That's what's more important. So whatever facilitates the sustaining, developing and sustaining of mindfulness of whatever base, that's what's most important. Upon awakening one morning, I found my mind was locked open in awareness. It seems this was stable as long as I did not do any conceptual thinking. Is this a feature of samadhi? Can it be cultivated? It can be a feature of samadhi, certainly. That sense of there's a stability of and clarity of awareness and a certain spaciousness of awareness that is and of course that's what we're cultivating and it can be in terms of samadhi that probably is it. I mean there's many facets to samadhi. But that is, part of it is that mindfulness or awareness is it, for it to be, for anything to be right samadhi, like we think in terms of on the path, samma samadhi, right samadhi, on the Noble Eightfold Path. And what is usually, and then it's sort of what's standard in the description is the four jhanas. But I think one of the aspects, of right samadhi that all the great teachers talk about is mindfulness or awareness. There is a, it's not, one isn't unaware or one isn't just so locked in that one can't direct attention or reflect in and it's not it's not necessarily discursive, but one can direct attention and it's important to recognize. So what absolutely can be cultivated, needs to be cultivated, and conceptual thinking, of course, is a great way to get the mind spinning. Can you offer practical advice for working with hindrances and cultivating sila without taking it personally? That is, trying to perfect the personality. Thanks. Well, I think it's just, that's a whole new perspective, isn't it? Just that sense of, all right, it's not about me. But it's just that recognizing that this whole practice of the Buddha's teaching, the Buddha's Dhamma, is to give ourselves the opportunity to just align ourselves with just the way things truly are. This is the way it is. And I can remember one of the phrases Ajahn Chah used to use in, you know, whether we are successful or we fail, or there's just abundant goodness, or all of a sudden we're thinking terrible thoughts. It's just this much. He said, "Kenanna." It's, and we, you know, we take, again, as we take it so personal, all it was a thought or a memory or an action or a feeling, and it doesn't have to be personalized. Or, you know, we can be incredibly successful. Okay, we've managed it. Moved on from the four jhanas, got the four formless jhanas all sort of nailed, and we're getting these insights. It's not about oneself. It's about everything. The whole path is about relinquishment and letting go. And letting go is not pushing anything away. It's just not picking anything up and making a burden out of anything. And so that that freedom from the hindrances is just, I mean, it's in and of itself, it's just wonderful. So just, yeah, go for it. You know, certainly cultivating sila. It's a real gift to oneself and gift to others around one. It's just this, you know, the world really needs more integrity, and it really needs it, and you can't wait for the rest of the world to get it together. It's up to us. Please offer your thoughts on how to cultivate the Brahma-viharas on and off the cushion. These qualities seem foundational for immeasurable benefit. So fun to be living this life through these qualities. Yeah, absolutely. One of the teachers in our tradition, Ajahn Vajiro, I think, was the one who I heard it from. When he talking about in teaching Brahma Viharas, then, which are usually translated as the divine abidings, it's loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, equanimity. He defined it as mature emotions, which I thought, oh yeah, right, spot on. Those are the kind of the mature emotions that a human being can live by, both in daily life as well as, you know, making much of in a meditative sense. So that turning attention to the expansive qualities that, say, that well-wishing of metta, is very expansive. The qualities of compassion are just really expansive, and both the, say, metta and karuna, all of the Brahma Viharas. Again, it's not a personal attainment or achievement. It's how we can be in the world with other people. We can be kind. We can be compassionate. We can delight in the success and the goodness of others. So mudita is sympathetic joy, but it's it really undermines that sort of jealousy and competition. I think, you know, in terms of modern societies, it's hard to find one more competitive than America. And so it there's not a whole lot of mudita. And so that's a really beautiful emotion to be cultivating. And equanimity is just, say, steadiness in the face of praise and blame, success and failure. It's not indifference, it's steady. And there is a equipoise in the midst of whatever is happening. And one can, it's a real gift to people when one is able to provide a certain amount of perspective of equanimity, because then things, you know, it's a whole different way of experiencing this. That's interesting. Yeah. So it's a real gift. Lifting the nimitta of metta is very helpful, eloquent, evocative. What are the words, practices to practice or develop equanimity? In this difficult, divisive period, it's helpful to have as much non-ill will as possible. And just that motivation is good. I don't need to be upset at this. I don't need to get outraged. Which is not what the and you know, one of the best ways to start is just not to look at the news. that's a real gift to yourself, because it's not there to inform you. It's there to create a reaction, their job is not to inform you in an equanimous way. Their job is to try to get clickbaits, and so that you know, and they're very successful, thank you. But that doesn't mean we need to participate. And that's a good way of being kind to oneself. And so practicing equanimity is just trying to... Because you'll hear about things anyway. It's like in a monastery. We hear about just about everything. Maybe a little bit later than others, but it's not that we live under a rock. Certainly the classical words that one uses for developing equanimity is the reflections on karma, the actions. I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions, abide supported by my actions. Whatever actions I shall do, for good or for ill, of that I will be the heir. And that, of course, extends to all beings are the owners of their actions, heirs to... The world is created out of intentional action, and knowing that there are causes and conditions, and it's important that it's not cause and effect. There are causes and conditions for things to be the way they are, and if we want to develop equanimity, we might start to, can I give more attention to the whatever causes and conditions have predicated or precipitated that situation? What is it that's motivated that person that's getting up my nose? what is it that, and can I reflect in that way rather than, oh, they did this and they shouldn't have done that, because that there isn't a beautiful ending to that, but that reflecting on the, what were the causes, and then that starts from a place of empathy, rather than objectification, and that's really important. And so that equanimity is then able to sort of start to lay a foundation for, again, this sense of equanimity, not indifferent, but it doesn't mean we have to buy into our reactivity or the reactivity of the world around us. Can you be a Buddhist and yet an I don't know agnostic about reincarnation? Well, the reality is nobody knows. I mean, I have a belief, but I haven't. Well, there's some people who do. The Dalai Lama speaks from his own experience. But even he says, I don't remember my previous life. I know that. What the tradition says, but I mean but for the most part, to me it's a plausible description of how life, the circle of life, functions. Verifiable and qualifiable, quantitatively verifiable. I'd be hard. I wouldn't be able to do that. So I mean, the thing is leaving it as an I don't know is important. But it's also, what are the benefits and what are the drawbacks to, say, having a belief. Either way, and certainly one of the things in the time of the Buddha not believing, does that put one into a category of being a nihilist? It can certainly. And if one is erring towards, if one's agnosticism is taking one to a place of nihilism, there is nothing. And why bother with anything? Then that's a problem. But in terms of taking it on as a, I don't know, but does it help me have a commitment to just the things we were talking about, punya, of the commitment to training? Because there is a result. You start seeing the results of actions in the present life, and that commitment to that, and then say, well, does that just disappear? Well, I don't know, but that's what the. I mean, if it's a, the Buddha, there's a discourse where the Buddha talks of very similar to Pascal's wager. It's a good bet. If you're going to bet on something, probably better to, it's a fortunate roll. By the way, the Buddha, it's a fortunate roll of the dice is that one has, say, invested in the, even though one doesn't, it's in conversation with a king who was not a believer, and he'd say that. But it's if one's honest about one's, yeah, I don't know, because as I began with, you know, on a certain, can I 100% affirm? Well, not really. So I mean, also on a certain level, I don't know. But also, what I believe in has come through a lot of reflection, investigation, also a lot of contact with people who do have personal experience. So that counts for a lot. But that's I spent a long time in a culture that it's just sort of part of the fabric. So it's not strange for people to talk about it, of their memories from previous lives. How does one navigate choice and self-advocacy and also equanimity? In my life, I often find myself feeling relatively content, yet defaulting slightly to people-pleasing and being quiet to get along. And I think just in the asking of the question is already highlighting a certain feeling of discomfort and wanting to put more attention on, yeah, looking after oneself, because you need to look after yourself. You have to look after others. It's a delicate balance, and certainly sometimes it's just easier to, and depending on the situation, depending on the people, then. Yeah, it's easier to not get in conflict. So it's just is. But if it's very it's conscious, then you make those choices at the appropriate time, and then make the choices to look after oneself really well. Because also, to a certain degree, it's also a looking after oneself in. Okay, do I need more conflict in my life? No, I can, certainly I can do without it. So, so it's just a lot of wisdom is actually knowing time and place and having a confidence in that knowledge of time and place, the right circumstance for which sort of response. I am in a challenging situation at work and thinking of moving to a different position. How can I tell whether this is, one, skillful? I recognize I'm clinging and it is time to let go. Or unskillful, things are hard, so I'm running away. I mean, sometimes one of the ways that you can, because yeah, I mean, we go around and around in circles with this in our minds. So that being able to, yeah, find a trusted friend who or co-worker who has a feeling for the situation and a feeling for, say, you personally, and lay it out and run it. But this is what I'm thinking. Well, this is what I'm feeling. This is where I'm leaning. Well, how's that sound? Because that's sometimes you know, we've chewed it over so much that it's hard to get any definition anymore of what the heck is actually going on. So that having, and this is where, you know, good friendships are so important. You don't have to rely on yourself all the time. The world looms large. This is the source of most of my turmoil. How does one see all this strife as neutral when we know that the damage to the world is so great? How do we maintain acceptance when our children and grandchildren will suffer? Well, the thing is it's not neutral. Things are charged and they have consequences. And part of the consequences that we have to be willing to acknowledge or let into consciousness is the world's going to hell in a handbasket. but that's a disaster scenario. But paying attention to what can I do? So it's really important to be able to make the choices that one go, what can I do in my sphere, in my world? What can I attend to that has a positive outcome? Because you have some control over that. And you have extended circles of contact, you have minimal to no, absolutely no control over. And the reality that, you know, some things are beyond our control is it's frustrating, but it's actually the way things actually are. So that, one hopes that there would be more people who would pay attention to what is really beneficial for the world, but one draws close to those people who one knows or as creating affiliations, but sometimes we can make small impacts, sometimes we can make major impacts. We don't really know unless we make that effort and just take responsibility. But taking responsibility for what we can take responsibility for. Ready or willing to be surprised when things actually go well. Or to not be shaken when things fall apart. That is more what, say, like equanimity is. Any suggestions for managing dizziness or nausea from the energy on retreat? Feeling a little overwhelmed today. I think one of the things is just lying down. Just lie down physically, relax, let whatever energies are coming up, just let them come through. Or if lying down is sort of increasing, then to go for a walk. And this nature is really soothing. Today it's a nice sunny day. I mean, yesterday was not much of an introduction to Pine Lake. Or the day before. Today is incredibly beautiful. And then either walking slowly or walking quickly. Whatever feels soothing to the system. On an energetic level, and just the those bringing to mind those feelings and thoughts of loving kindness. May I abide in well-being. And that wishing oneself well is really important. But I think that paying attention to the body is really important, because sometimes the energy sort of course up and down, and it just is. Let that the sort of the weight and the gravity of the body just help to settle things. Well, this I'm more or less covered in a previous question on reincarnation. It was sort of welcome to sunny Wisconsin. You can see why there is a lake. Question, what is your personal view on what happens to us when we die? Have you had any experiences to support that view? Is there any benefit to knowing our past lives if we had them? Yeah, I think I covered that in that previous question, more or less. I might. How does one reconcile when witnessing perceived imperfections, unskillful behavior in Buddhist institutions and interactions with teachers? And brackets, not about you or matters in insight. Well, one is that, an institution is an institution, and institutions are conglomerates of human beings, and human beings are sometimes not perfect. Sometimes they're way less than perfect. I think it is important. I think that's one of the, to me, it's always impressed me with the Buddha's teachings and the Buddha's monastic form is that the monastics, as like a teacher or the monks but particularly in terms of being a teacher, the junior monks and the lay people are, we're fair game for criticism. If we've been, and it's also a duty of the junior monks to admonish the senior monks if they have done something that's inappropriate, and if it's the Buddha's addressing this 2600 years ago, and if it is uncomfortable because of the relationship between student and teacher, then it's the duty of the student to find another more senior monk who can admonish for one. So it's like it's not assuming. The Buddha set up an institution that was not assuming infallibility. I mean, the Buddha understood human nature really well, so as an institution and as teachers, then you always have to be open to criticism. You have to be And you have to pay attention to, is that criticism valid or is it not? Because sometimes people will criticize, well, you get criticized. Even the Buddha got criticized. So he says, no, the Buddha said, nobody lives a human life without being criticized. But it's how you respond or react to that criticism, because I mean sometimes it's, you know, you have to pay attention. Is that a valid criticism? Does it require me to reflect and change? And then one should be changing. Or is it, I don't know, they're just upset for some reason, and it's not really about me personally or the institution personally. It's more about them. Then you have to find a way to try to support them or in some way. But it you can't live your life trying to please people all the time. But certainly in say witnessing inappropriate conduct, even in a Buddhist institution or with people who are supposed to be in leadership positions, and it's important. But it's also important to time and place where you ask for permission to can I bring something up? Might be difficult. Would you be willing to talk with me about it? Just a skillfulness of how one, you don't just sort of come in and dump on somebody. I mean, it doesn't really work, whoever it is. So it's there's a skillfulness in how one constructive criticism. It's important because that's it is important to address, because say an institution or a teacher doesn't really grow unless foibles and flaws are pointed out. It's just the reality of the human condition, and it requires those mirrors or reflections to do that. We can't see everything in a clear way sometimes. Okay. 50 wasas, ! Highs, lows, ! What are you contemplating these days? Well, I'm still delighting in the Dhamma, that's for sure. That is, 50 vasas, I'm not bored with with the Buddha's teachings. And I find it an amazing gift to humanity, these teachings of truth. The highs, I mean, there's many highs, many lows, 50 years. What pops the mind in terms of lows is taking on responsibility as an abbot. Boy. And leading a community of Westerners. Man, opinions. Personalities, gosh. But the highs are also having learned from that and seeing people grow. I mean, it's a real high to see people grow. Highs certainly of, I think it was in retrospect, just how incredibly fortunate I was to meet Ajahn Chah and live and train with Ajahn Chah. So those are real highs, and you kind of reflect on that and say, wow, I really must have done something right in the past life and stumble in there. Can you talk about fear as a cause of dukkha and how to work with them? Fear, to me, it's not articulated. So, like when the Buddha talks about the root kilesa, the root defilements of the mind that are a source of dukkha, and say lobha, dosa, moha, like greed, hatred, delusion. And it all for many years it was a puzzle to me of, well, where does fear fit into that? And then I came across I was reading some Abhidhamma text and that fear is a moha condition, and so like a delusion condition. And but you realize that. Because moha is also can be a seed for greed and hatred, and it's a little bit delusion ends up being more complicated than just being a bit confused, and fear is a moha condition, and it's like, oh, that makes sense, because it's that lack of seeing things clearly that we get. Wrapped up in different fears and different anxieties and different worries. And that was my, in terms of personality, that was my go-to option. Fear, anxiety, I could always rely on that. But in terms of how to working with them, I really found like mindfulness of the body is just so important, because it clarifies, there's a solid base for mindfulness and a continuity of awareness and attention, that once you start having that continuity and clarity, and fear being a delusional state, then it doesn't have a foundation. It gets dissipated. The rug gets pulled out from underneath it, so it doesn't gain any traction in the mind. And so that there are places where the Buddha does talk about fear, in many discourses he talks about the prevalence of fear, but then he also, there's a set of mental stains that comes up over and over again, and they're what are called in Pali the akati, and akati is usually translated as bias, but literally what it means is to lean. So that one leans and topples over into a particular, like, the bias of desire, the bias of ill will, the bias of delusion, the bias of fear, but it causes the heart to lean and fall over into a particular unskillful state or quality. And so that fear is, I think, work with mindfulness of the body in terms of just getting that, having a solid foundation for a continuity of attention and awareness, is just really important for dealing with fear. When one moves through the world in compassion and loving kindness, how does one avoid feeling depleted? In a world of quote unquote individuals, most take more than they give, and to always be giving can feel exhausting. Well, I mean, I think one of the, of course, always the way out is through recognizing this truth of the fundamental truth of the Buddhist teachings of not self. This is not me, not mine. So even you move through the world with compassion and loving kindness, but it's not me. Me and my compassion and me and my wonderful loving kindness that's so precious that people take it from me. it was like we were talking about last night in the Four Noble Truths, gives us an opportunity to shift perspective away from self and other, being and non-being, to what is skillful, what's unskillful, what's wholesome, what's unwholesome, what's beneficial, what's not beneficial. And then we don't have to invest the sense of I and me and mine into that. It is sustainable in and of itself because it is wholesome and skillful. And it's that seeing the dukkha involved in creating an identity and identification with particular mental states, even if they are wholesome and skillful. That it's how we avoid that being depleted, because that's when we're attentive to freedom from suffering, then there's an inexhaustible well of goodness there. I wake remembering my dreams often, and at times in the dream know I am dreaming. There are interesting aspects to this, but also at times I find it intense or tiring. Meditation before bed seems to intensify this. Suggestions? Or must the Dharma be known in both realms for lasting peace? Well, yeah, it is true. We do need to know that. But we also have to recognize what the effects are. And certainly, yeah, meditating, especially if you have a decent meditation before bed, usually lends itself to more alertness and more clarity in the dream state. But it's also, as we continue to reflect, and reflecting on dreams, there's many different kinds of dreams. Some of them are just excess verbiage that needs some kind of displacement. Some of it is an imbalance within ourselves, where some of it is prophetic. There's some clarity that is being experienced. So there's a whole range, and just to be able to increase one's sense of non-attachment to the personalization of our experiences, it lends itself to a sense of peace and ease that one can have certain Yeah, certain alertness. Because sometimes, also sometimes we're, we can be alert and then it can be really tiring because we're, there's a certain, yeah, there's a certain intensity, or there's a certain biting into the experience. But as we get more clarity around experience, then it can, we can experience that the sharpness of dream states and even the messages that can come from the, because it's, that's, it's part of our same mind, and it gives us some yeah, it's energizing, and we're not so concerned about, okay, because sometimes we're tired because we think we should be tired. And it's like, I do, like I go to a, I've been going to a Tibetan doctor for I don't know, almost 20 years now, and she still asks me every, how much are you sleeping? And it's just this, it's just so disappointing to her. You need more sleep. I don't need more sleep. It's what it's I'm comfortable with, especially when now I'm getting older, I do need more sleep. I mean, now, before it was between 4 and 5 hours sleep, but now I need more than five. It's, but you know, by most people's standards, that's I'm deprived. I'm sleep deprived. but there is a clarity within the dream state, and then it's also as one. That gets transferred from the mindfulness, and so sometimes it can be a bit disconcerting that we're you know, we've got there's an energy there, but as we just get more comfortable and used to mindfulness of the body itself, mindfulness itself, and this process of letting go, then it all, there's a place for everything. That's the thing. I don't think we're going to be able to get back to the online question, since this is the last, very last one for here, and I think we'll. I'm having a little bit of trouble with some of the words in the writing, but I think I got the gist of this. My husband died 10 years ago. There was sadness and also relief that his journey was over, and sadness and relief for myself. A statistician, he is still with me. As I take a lot of meds, I can quote-unquote hear him say, don't change this, or meds, this, you know, don't take meds at these meds at the same time. The results will confound you. And that's, I'm having trouble reading there. Is this clinging or not? He lives in my heart. What do you do with memories and teachings yourself? You listen to them. And, you know, somebody's, okay, it's your husband. 10 years on a certain level. 10 years is a long time in some areas and some ways of feeling. 10 years is, boop, it's no time at all. so that for there to be that presence there, I would say that is normal, I would say that's a good sign, in that one hasn't sort of expunged the memories of sort of, oh, there's a, and I can certainly, I've had in my, I can hear, so Ajahn Chah really died 30 odd years ago, and he wasn't speaking the last bit of his life. I still hear his voice. I'll dream of Ajahn Chah still, after all this time. And another teacher who I dream of, not so much in the last few years, but Ajahn Mahabua. I didn't have so much connection or contact with him, but or I didn't have so much contact. I had a nice connection with him, and so that over the years, I dreamt of him and things come. And so I think something that's important to ones, the people who are been important in one's life, their memory lives on, and that's, to me, that's not a, not a bad thing. So that to be able to, to honor that memory or listen to it, and say in the same way as a husband and wife. So I mean, some of the things you paid attention to and some you didn't. So it's just sorting it out. Okay, that was an hour and a half.